Welcome. This is Dr. Susan Cole with Temple of Health Radio Show, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Beatrice Hunter, who is the author of Infectious Connections, How Short-Term Foodborne Infections Can Lead to Long-Term Health Problems. This book is especially timely for me as I am doing some research on the FDA at this time, and many of the FDA informational things in this book I've been researching, not so much from a food safety standpoint, but from implant safety standpoint, GM foods, nanotechnology, cellular telephones, radiation devices, but certainly food safety is something that all of us need to be concerned about. Welcome, Beatrice. Where are you calling from?
I'm in New Hampshire.
Great. Well,
and
how did
snowing?
It's snowing.
It's
I think
snowing.
We're supposed to have an ice storm down here on Monday, and believe me, you'd be better off with an ice storm in New Hampshire than Atlanta.
We're at least well equipped.
Right. Well, certainly, I think anybody who has been listening to the media in the last 10 years or so realizes that we have not managed to assure safety of our food, especially in restaurants, and food coming in from out of the country. We have many areas in which food safety could be improved, and there are frequent outbreaks of many of the infectious diseases that you talk about in your book. And I particularly like how you've prepared sections on food safety and what we can do as consumers to avoid exposure to risky food. Would you like to give a little bit of your background and how you came to be interested in this subject?
Well, the food safety, of course, is something that affects all of us. And through the years, I have followed not only this issue, but also what FDA and the USDA have been doing about it.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the FDA is very underfunded and understaffed, and that's one of the problems that we faced. The amount of imported food, for example, has increased enormously in the last decade, and yet the FDA is only able to inspect about 1% of the imported food that comes in. It's only able to inspect factories where food is prepared only once every 5 years. So you can see what the problem is.
Yeah, the people in foreign countries are more likely to be infected themselves and then transfer the infective agent to the food supply. And it's not just, you know, processed and canned foods. It's actually fresh foods.
True.
Alfalfa and sprouts and, you know, all
yes.
The...
And, of course, there's very little inspection in some of the countries. It depends,
right,
of course, which country we're speaking of.
Right. And we also see a lot more restaurants with foreign workers that may have a higher risk of being contaminated, and then
yes,
with poor,
and they're,
yeah,
mm-hmm, and they're poor. They're so poorly paid that even when they are ill, they're very reluctant to stay home because of the
right
loss of pay or the fear of being fired. So
right
that they may go in and handle food and infect the food because of their own problems.
Yeah, there was a outbreak of hepatitis in the doctor's lounge at a hospital I went to. Several doctors became ill with hepatitis from a food worker. And then they made some changes, you know. Some.
Yes, it's not uncommon. And
not
of
uncommon.
Course, and of course, as everything grows larger in terms of the numbers of people being served, the problem becomes worse because more people are affected.
Mm-hmm.
If you had years ago small restaurants where only local people ate, or a church supper, for example, mm-hmm. there would be only a limited number of people who were affected. But now mm-hmm. where we have this mass distribution of food and mass eating places, the numbers of people can be much more in terms of the infections.
There was E. coli breakouts at both Jack in the Box and Burger King, for example, which are
yes.
national chains, because of supply to, you know, supply problems with, or supply of contaminated foods, with especially hamburger, within these companies.
And, yes, and in the case, for example, of airplane travel, if there's any infection from the food, the people are widely scattered in all sections mm-hmm. of the country after they land, so that it's very difficult to trace back
right.
An infection that can affect many, many people.
Yeah, I wanted to mention a little more the findings of the FDA Science Board. In 2007, I have that document, and essentially this committee was asked to, I guess it was a three-person committee, was asked to research this and make a report on it. And basically what they said was that the FDA's mission is at risk because the science is not able to be kept up with, primarily because of some of the things we just mentioned. There's just too many new risks out there. There are problems with foreign sources, contamination outside where we could even inspect, and then the increasing demands on the FDA have not been met with increasing resources. So
that's
the FDA
right.
just isn't able to do the job. And that report came out in 2007.
Well, and since then, the load of the FDA has even increased.
Yeah, they brought in devices.
In addition to the devices and overseeing food and drugs and medicine and cosmetics, they
right.
also now have taken on the tobacco. So they have this ever-increasing load and not a perceptibly increased
right.
Funding or staffing.
Right. And so inspection in many cases is not possible. And I think when we look at the recent serious outbreak of salmonella inside eggs. This wasn't a contamination around the eggs. It was actually inside the eggs. It occurred in 2008 and 2009. All the other foodborne illnesses that have led to all the recalls, you have to conclude that the safety of the food in the U.S. is really in question.
Well, yes. I suppose if you look at it from the worldwide perspective, it's fairly safe.
Right,
but
exactly.
It could be made much safer. And until recently, the FDA didn't even have a power to recall food.
Right.
Recently, now, there has been some legislation which at least gives them the power to recall, because prior to that, the only thing that they could do would be to suggest or to urge the industry involved
to
make a voluntary recall.
And that's true of cosmetics, too.
Yes. The USDA has a much stronger control, and that
mm-hmm.
is the meat inspector must be in any of the meat plants where the meat is then shipped interstate. Mm-hmm. And if there's any grave problem in the plant, what the USDA will do is simply to withdraw the inspector. And once the inspector is withdrawn, the plant has to be shut down.
Right.
So that really is a very strong control.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Food Safety Act. I guess that's what you're talking about, the recent legislation.
Yes, which is the act is the first major one for more than 100 years,
mm-hmm.
which is really astonishing. The original one was 1906.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, it hasn't been altered perceptibly since then. So this is really, we can hail it as a great stroke of luck that we've gotten this, although it doesn't go very far, but it is a step forward.
So what are the basic, I'm not real familiar with the act, what has it achieved?
Well, I think that the most important feature really that is being stressed is the FDA's new ability now to announce a recall.
Okay. Anything else enabling the FDA to do its job better?
There are other aspects, but nothing that's quite as dramatic as that.
Okay. And do you attribute the inability of the passage of this act in the past to be due to the lobbying forces of the food industry?
Well, it's a complicated issue, as you can imagine, because many of the responsible people in industry really want this. They feel that there is a much better perception on the part of the public that there is safety
mm-hmm.
being enforced if there are controls such as this. It does not cover, however, many of the small companies or the producers, because the cost of that would be prohibitive for many of them. So it doesn't cover everybody.
I was having dinner with one of my patients, acquaintances, who was prominent in the beef industry, and we were out at a seafood restaurant, and he was telling me that there is virtually no regulation of seafood in the U.S., so that it's very important to know the quality of what's being served and how it's being handled based on the reputation of the restaurant you're eating in.
And of course, the individual restaurant really doesn't have much control. They have to depend on the supplier, and the whole chain is really a difficult one. With so many of the outbreaks of serious infectious diseases from shellfish and finfish,
mm-hmm.
It would really be very wise for people not to eat raw fish.
Period.
I know that this is bad news for some people who adore sushi
mm-hmm.
and also who love to eat raw clams or raw oysters.
Right.
But to be on the safe side, it really is much better to eat cooked food and also mm-hmm. well-cooked, because if it's not well-cooked, there's still the possibility of infection. I know this is not very happy news, but
no.
It is one that is within our control in terms of keeping our bodies safer.
I spent 13 years in the Air Force as a physician and a physician in training. There was a squadron of pilots stationed in Spain that went out and ate oysters. And everybody got hepatitis. One, however, went on to develop primary biliary cirrhosis and subsequently died the night before he was supposed to get a liver transplant. So this brings us to the next important part of our interview, which is there can be very serious effects of foodborne illness, including death. And much of it is from an autoimmune mechanism. And so although the majority of people getting foodborne illnesses might have, you know, stomach cramps, diarrhea, fever, the short-term things, a certain percentage of people with many of these infections will go on to develop more serious autoimmune diseases that might even threaten their life.
Yes, and that, of course, is one of the points that I make in the book, Infectious Connections, because it's not just a short-term problem. If it leads to long-range health problems, and sometimes the connection isn't even made in the minds of people, and yet every system of the body and every organ of the body and every tissue of the body can be affected with long-range chronic illnesses, as well as possible death.
Right. I wrote a book called The Naked Truth About Breast Implants, and in it I have 8 patient stories. One of them is an FDA research scientist who got saline breast implants thinking they were safe because, after all, they were FDA approved. Unfortunately, she had HLA B27, and she got pretty seriously ill within a couple of weeks of having silicone in her body. And she called me up, and I just said to her, I said, I think you have HLA B27, go get tested. And sure enough, she did. Mm-hmm. And it's very important to understand that certain genetic types, and in your book, you state that Caucasians in the U.S., 10%, is it 10% have HLA B27?
Yeah, I don't really remember the percentage.
Yeah, I remember because I just read it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's
yes.
an incredible number.
Surely.
1 in 10, if you're putting breast implants in or silicone of any kind, because silicone's used in a lot of implants, that
mm-hmm.
put people at risk for autoimmune disease.
Yeah.
And then you say that in the book several times that the presence of certain HLA types, especially B27, and there actually are some other ones too for mold. We deal a lot with mold in
mm-hmm.
saline breast implants and around silicone too, and the HLA types are very specific there for inability to get the biotoxin out of the body. So those people get sick with fibromyalgia and saline implants pretty regularly can get mold around them, especially if they're older. And I'm sure that's another whole aspect of foodborne illness that people don't realize. I know that I quit eating at fast food restaurants because occasionally I'd have bread and I get deathly ill within just hours of eating it. And it was mold biotoxin, mold in the
mm-hmm.
bread.
Yeah, and the mold issue is another one that the FDA and USDA has to deal with. There is a great problem with the aflatoxins, especially on grain crops such as corn.
Right.
And these are very virulent toxins.
They can cause liver cancer, as a matter of fact.
Yes. Coming back to the foodborne diseases, something mm-hmm. like the Campylobacter jejuni, which is one of the 4 major infections from food, there's a definite connection between that and acute bacterial gastroenteritis, which is
mm-hmm.
associated with chronic health disorders such as the Guillain-Barré syndrome. So there are these connections that have been made. There are probably many other health connections that await being discovered in terms of the connections.
Yeah, I think there's 2 major things that I'm familiar with. One is the molecular mimicry, which you talk about in your book. That's where certain antigens that might be present on the myelin sheath are attacked because the body is attacking a pathogen that's, you know, a foodborne pathogen. But the other thing that I think happens, and I think we're going to find more about this, is that a lot of bacteria have the capability of becoming intracellular pathogens. And the intracellular spirochetes and intracellular mycobacterium have been highly implicated in autoimmune disease. So, you know, perhaps mm-hmm. there's something about some of these some of these organisms or some of these co-infections becoming intracellular and thus hiding out from the antibiotics we're giving people.
Well, and another aspect of this is the fact that the pathogens themselves are changing in nature.
Right.
Some of the pathogens that had been very mild years ago have become much more virulent, and some that have, we didn't even identify years ago seem to be emerging. So we have this double whammy of the more virulent ones and the newly emerging ones. And they really do, they're very wily creatures, as you know, if you've examined any of the pathogens. They seem to be able to change form and what they're doing to keep alive. And they'll do it in very ways that are really, I think, quite clever if you examine them.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the toxoplasmosis in that regard. You have a fascinating story in your book about how the rat or mice infected with toxoplasmosis has changes in its behavior, and you want to talk about that a little bit, because that's fascinating.
Yes, I think that that was one of the most fascinating pathogens that I had read about. It's a pathogen that has to get into some feline, whether it's a cat, which is domesticated or feral, or it could be a bobcat or any kind of a any in the cat family. It has to get into that. And then it also rewires the brain of the mouse or the rat so that it's no longer fearful of the feline. It's really, it's an amazing creature, I think, this toxoplasmosis.
Yeah, so the mice might be attracted to the cat scent.
Right.
That's amazing.
Yeah, rather than fleeing,
right.
It
seeks out the cat.
and
becomes dinner.
Well, this is, I think, a very good example of the wiliness of these pathogens to achieve their goal.
Yeah, and then the toxoplasmosis may be linked with schizophrenia, which is interesting. So it may affect
also,
the brain of humans once they're affected.
Mm-hmm. And also, it's a pathogen that pregnant women should be especially aware of, because if there's any domesticated cat in the house, it would be very wise for the pregnant woman not to handle the litter box, have somebody else in the family dispose of it, because infection with that is very possible, and one
and not go digging in the soil outside either, because cats, you know.
True.
And toxoplasmosis can cause visual blindness and mental retardation in the fetus.
Retardation if the child,
from the infected
born.
Mother, yeah.
Yeah. You know, as I remember, it also has a high incidence of that is causing a high incidence of miscarriages.
Mm-hmm, right. Which might be better than having the,
the child born with the
severely affected
vision and also mental retardation.
Right, right. So, yeah, that's very important. And cats that never eat mice, though, that only eat cat food are probably okay?
Well, if the cat is kept indoors completely, the chances are it has not been infected. However,
unless there's mice inside.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, occasionally,
if you're in an old country house with mice, then there's no assurance that the cat has not caught the mice.
But usually, I've had cats before, and usually, if they catch a mouse, they bring it right to you because they're proud of it. Especially if they're indoor cats.
Yes.
So you usually know if they're. You usually know if you have mice. I mean, eventually, because you hear them or you find their feces.
But pregnant women should be aware of this, whether the cat is kept indoors all of the time or
right.
not.
Yes.
And certainly working in the garden, that's another feature where there might be exposure
pieces,
to the infection.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, these are fascinating stories. I learned a great deal reading your book. I already knew a great deal, but I guess I didn't realize how often problems can occur. One of my friends related to me that she had eaten at a restaurant that's a chain restaurant and had some what she felt was tainted soup. A cream soup, and she developed this horrible GI illness, and then later on developed a vascular problem with her gut because of it, and ended up with several surgeries, so including removing some of her intestine. Now that's an amazing story. She was a physician.
Yes, it is. From what you would feel is a very simple thing to have soup in a restaurant, I would suggest to anybody that if you have soup in a restaurant and it is served to you only lukewarm, because
mm-hmm.
sometimes it's just heated in a microwave oven
right.
and you're not very careful about the heating, send it back to the kitchen and ask them to really bring it to a boil.
Right, yeah,
because,
that's a good idea.
Because the lukewarm soup is not something that is absolutely safe.
And,
if it's piping hot,
right.
it will be.
Mm-hmm. And this restaurant was the kind where you know, it's a soup and salad bar. So
yes.
Soup is, and really, salad bars and places where soups are just in containers and just sit there heated all day, you might want to avoid that,
Right. Well,
there's been an awful lot of reports of different illnesses coming out of, the food bars.
Yes, and I think that if you eat out at all, you really have to be your own food inspector.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the cleanliness of the restaurant. See whether the people who are handling food with their hands are wearing gloves.
Mm-hmm.
See whether the people who are handling food are also managing
well.
The cash register. When
true.
I was a child, we ate out very rarely.
Mm-hmm.
But when we did, my mother was her own inspector.
Mm-hmm.
She would march right into the bathroom of the
mm-hmm.
restaurant. And if the bathroom was not clean, she just assumed that the kitchen was not clean
well,
either.
Isn't that interesting?
And
yeah.
we would march out of the restaurant without even looking at the menu.
Yeah, that's fascinating that you had a mother that did that, and then you came to write all these books on food safety.
My mother had used one butcher for many years. That was
mm-hmm.
at the time when there were still butcher shops. And it was only after a number of years that she was a patron that he realized that she was not a secret inspector from the health department, because she always looked around to see the cleanliness, and she insisted that before he grind her meat, that he clean the meat grinder, because she didn't know what was being ground prior
like
to what she was having
right.
ground, and it might have been pork.
Right.
And she also watched that he didn't tip his hand on the scale as he was weighing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. That brings us to a little bit of kitchen food safety, which is never take a knife and cut meat and then cut something else and eat it.
Right.
Without thoroughly washing your knife. You had mentioned in the book that pork from the U.S. is not welcome in other countries. Would you like to comment on why that is?
Yes, surely. In other countries, especially European countries and Asian countries, raw pork is inspected microscopically, so that if there are any trichina, which are the pathogens that produce the trichinosis, if they are present, then they will be discovered. So any raw pork that is sold in those countries is assumed to be safe to be used in a raw form.
Mm-hmm.
And many of those countries do use pork in a raw form. So some of the people who have emigrated to America from those countries just assume that raw pork is safe. And here the inspectors have never done the microscopic inspection. They depend instead on the people preparing the pork to cook it thoroughly. So it's a very different approach to it. And so for this reason, some of the people who have emigrated have had very serious infections of trichinosis,
right,
because they've used the raw pork in their traditional foods.
Yeah. And you mentioned with the beef, too, and I imagine it's true with pork as well, meats can become discolored. And the discoloration can fool the cooks, especially in very thick, like hamburgers, because
yes,
the middle of the hamburger can still be
right. It
raw.
It can still be
even though it's brown,
undercooked, and yet appear brown,
right?
Because of the oxidation. So that thorough cooking. I know that this is terrible news for people who really like rare steak or rare hamburger, but to be on the side of safety, it really is better to eat the meat better cooked.
Yeah, the prion disease is serious too. Many cases Alzheimer's are actually Jacob Creutzfeldt disease.
Yeah, that's a whole issue which has been a very grave one, especially in Great Britain, where millions of cows had to be slaughtered because of the this highly infectious disease.
Yeah. We had a prominent hospital in Emory have to send letters to a lot of its patients because a patient who was later found out to be infected with prion disease had neurosurgery, and the instruments weren't processed whatever way has to be processed. There's something where the normal steam autoclave processing doesn't kill the prion.
That's right.
The letters had to go out to all these people saying that they might have been contaminated during surgery with a prion.
Yeah, the prions are not deactivated until the temperature reaches an enormously high degree. And
much higher than bacteria or even virus.
Oh, yes, much, much higher. And freezing does not destroy them,
right. And
drying does not destroy them. They've been found in soil after 5 years. They're still viable. So it's a very strong pathogen, very difficult to destroy.
And basically, you're commonly exposed to it in beef that's close to the spinal cord. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Meat that's close to the spinal cord. Of course, you don't know. I mean, if you get a hamburger, you don't know where that meat comes
from. Well, it used to be used in hamburger. Now
it isn't
prohibited from being added to the hamburger.
Okay. Well,
but
that's
of course, hamburger is no longer the way it used to be years ago, where the butcher would grind it freshly.
Right.
It comes from maybe 50 different sources in one hamburger, and the meat,
which increases the likelihood of foodborne infection.
So you have no idea, of what goes in with the grinding, and also if there's even one source out of those 50 that is contaminated, then
right.
The entire batch will be contaminated. Yes.
That's right.
I guess we should really speak about hand washing, because that seems to be one of the low-tech and yet very important features to prevent foodborne illness. It sounds as if it might be something very simple as a topic, and yet I found that I had to devote an entire chapter to hand washing, because for one thing, many people don't do it frequently enough. And they don't do it thoroughly enough.
Right.
So it really does mean thoroughly wetting the hands, preferably with hot water or warm, very warm water, and soap, and really scrub. And to scrub sufficiently long so that the hands really are
clean. That's kind of like before you go into surgery. Also, if you're grinding meat or anything, you get it under your fingernails too.
That's right.
The fingernails. So if you don't clean your fingernails, all the hand washing in the world isn't going to really keep your, those hands from contaminating something else.
True.
If that meat's contaminated.
Well, anybody handling food really should have short nails, and also use a nail brush with the
right.
washing. Yeah, the food industry is very aware of this, and I think that they've taken a lot of good steps to make certain that the workers working with food, raw food, have either gloved hands or they're washing their hands frequently. And in the home, that is really one of the features. If you've touched any raw meat or poultry or eggs or fish, then you should immediately wash your hands and the surface that they have touched. And in terms of cutting boards, I think it's the simplest is to use two different cutting boards.
Mm-hmm.
One that you use exclusively for the raw animal foods,
mm-hmm.
and the other one for things like bread or cutting up fruits or vegetables for
mm-hmm.
salads, and to keep those separate.
Same
and
thing with
also,
knives, really, you know, maybe.
Yes, and the wooden ones seem to be actually safer than the plastic ones,
mm-hmm.
which surprises many people, but the board that has been touched with the raw animal protein food should be sanitized.
Right.
And the whole area in the kitchen should be sanitized frequently to keep it really clean wherever you're working in the kitchen with foods.
And I was surprised to hear from your book that dishwashers aren't always able to sanitize things, because, you know, I thought they were.
That's right. Sometimes the water is not hot enough, or there may be some defect where the rinsing is not done properly.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, even with hand washing of the dishes, you have to do it carefully and use
mm-hmm.
a lot of rinsing.
Right, right.
Once people are aware of these things, I think whatever they're doing becomes habit, and after a while it's really not, you don't even think about it, but you perform these rites of the frequent hand washing, for example.
Mm-hmm. So, and on kind of overview, some of the things that you would advise people to avoid are basically any raw meats, seafood,
undercooked eggs.
Undercooked eggs, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sushi.
Sushi.
I know that comes as really very bad news for some
people. Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think these days it's really hard to, you know, to know that something is well, like you said, the whole chain of where the raw fish came from.
Well, and you have to assume that once you bring any food into your house, you have to handle it carefully, because you don't really know what has happened to it from the time it was produced or cultivated. And the time that it gets to you, it goes through a whole chain of different types of operations, and there can be something that happens to it all along that chain. The food industry now has what they call a hazard analysis and critical control point, where they try to check on the safety at every point
mm-hmm.
along the chain of food production. And this has been helpful, but it's not the whole answer. And ultimately, once the food gets into your home, you have to be dealing with it properly. And if you're eating out, then you also have to make good food choices.
And many of the raw foods, like the strawberries and the foods coming from foreign countries such as Guatemala and Mexico have been more likely to be contaminated. So
right.
The source of your fresh, you know, your produce. And
we're getting more of the fresh produce that is imported.
You need to be more wary of that.
Right. So everything such as the strawberries and other raw berries have to be really washed thoroughly before you use it. And if you're visiting a farm and the tomatoes look beautiful or the berries look beautiful, there is a temptation to eat it right there if it's sun-kissed. But don't, because there are bird droppings, there are rodents
right.
coming into the area, and for safety's sake, don't eat it right in the field, although it is very tempting. Yeah.
And then, of course, when people travel to certain third world countries, they need to be aware of not taking any liquids that aren't bottled.
Absolutely, yes. And
ice being one of them. Ice is not.
Ice being one of them. And,
yeah.
and some people have a notion that if they drink alcohol and beverages, that will take care of it, but it doesn't.
Mm.
The alcohol does not kill the pathogen. But if you're traveling in developing countries, the best advice is to stay away from any of the raw fruits, which look very tempting, unless
yeah.
the fruit has a very thick rind, such as an orange or watermelon or something like
peeled.
That.
Right.
But other than those fruits, it would be best to use only the cooked foods.
Mm-hmm.
And piping hot soups are always in order.
Right. So
and
do you... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, even the bottled water in some countries is not very reliable because the bottled water just consists of regular water.
The water that they put in the bottle.
Tap that has been bottled. So even that really should be boiled. You
what
can
about
take a little
distilled water? Is that safe if it's
well,
distilled on it?
Well, distilled certainly is safer.
Uh-huh.
But you're not going to use that over a lifetime because you would not be getting all of the minerals that are in the water. But as a temporary measure, it would be good. And you can also invest in some immersion heater, which a small one, which you can take along with you, and you can boil your own water.
Mm-hmm. I have a great thing. That is a, let's see, what is it? It's a SteriPen. So you put it in a bottle and turn it on for 10 seconds, and it sterilizes everything in the bottle.
Oh, very good.
I think it's, I'm trying to think, I guess it's UV light.
Mm-hmm.
Or something similar. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's
mm-hmm.
called a SteriPen. You can
yeah.
buy them
yeah.
and carry them with you. And you can even sterilize big things of water, you know, like your big containers of water.
Oh, then
it takes
that
longer,
would be very...
but you can do it with a SteriPen.
Yeah, that would be useful. I did have some device that somebody had given to me to take on trips, but I think that it was, would it be silver nitrate that was put in a drop of that in the water, and then it
probably
went through some kind of a filter. But the equipment was bulky in terms
mm-hmm.
of travel.
Right.
And I really wasn't certain whether it would work or not. I had the feeling that the boiling of the water was really more secure.
Yeah, it probably is. That's true. Although silver technology is really good against a lot of pathogens that are resistant to other treatments, you know.
Yes. Yes.
We've used silver extensively in surgery
mm-hmm.
Because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Wound care products, anyway. Do you have some contact information you'd like to give the audience? You have a website or?
No.
Okay. Well, let's just give you the name of your book again. It's Infectious Connections, How Short-Term Foodborne Infections Can Lead to Long-Term health problems. And you had some other books too, The Whole Foods Primer, Probiotic Foods for Good Health, The Sweetener Trap and How to Avoid It. I assume that's on the artificial sweeteners.
Yes. Well, it's all sugars, both
all
caloric
sugars?
and the non-caloric ones.
Okay.
Yes. And I have another book that is due out in July. Would you like to know what it is?
Yes.
It's going to be called Our Toxic Legacy, and the subtitle of it is How Lead, Mercury, Arsenic, and Cadmium Harm Our Health.
That, I'd love to interview you on that when it comes out.
Very good.
That would be great.
I would look forward to it, Dr. Kolb.
That would be great. Well, let's talk just for a minute about how effective probiotics can be in limiting the duration of some of these gastrointestinal illnesses from foodborne, especially if they're bacterial. There's actually a peer-reviewed study showing that if you take probiotics at the beginning of a gastrointestinal illness, that's assuming you can keep it down. I'm sure that if it's very violent, it comes right back up, but that it will decrease the length of the illness by about half on average, which is well worth it in my book. I mean,
Surely. For those in the audience who may not be very familiar with the term probiotic, very simply, it's the fermented foods such as sauerkraut and yogurt. And there are other vegetables that can also be fermented. I use them daily. I mm-hmm. enjoy the taste of them, for one thing. And they do help strengthen the immune system so that if you are exposed to any infectious disease via the food, it does help you to shorten the time of the infection. I get not only the red cabbage sauerkraut and green cabbage sauerkraut, I also get fermented grated beets,
mm-hmm.
Carrots, daikon radish, and there's also onion and other root vegetables that can be fermented. Some people use the it's the oriental fermented vegetables. It's quite spicy. I'm trying to think of the name of it.
Oh, bok choy or something?
There is. It's a relish. It's used as a relish.
Okay.
It's
in Korean restaurants. I know that.
Yes, it is. It's very hot in terms mm-hmm. of the pepper and spiciness.
Right.
But the ones that I use are just very mild and very flavorsome. But the probiotics are very helpful.
Yeah, kefir is another one that people use that can be helpful. And, you know, essentially many of the third world countries or developing countries, as you say, have a great deal of spice and these kinds of foods, these fermented foods, probably to help the population resist infections that are more common there.
And
that's probably why they've got it in the first place, because it works.
Right. The quest for the spices during the time of Columbus was not only to make bland food taste better and also have a greater variety, but probably there was some basic understanding that it also was good for health.
Right.
They didn't really realize at the time why, but it probably did keep down the pathogenic infections.
And the other thing that was in your book that I really believe to be helpful is the garlic extracts of, what is it, alanine? Or
allicin.
Allicin.
Yes, allicin.
Very, very important at decreasing H. pylori and other infectious.
Yes, and it's antifungal as well.
Right.
And I think, doesn't it also bring down the blood pressure?
Yes, it
if
does. So garlic, you know, raw or what I do is take garlic tablets, which are more high in the allicin,
mm-hmm.
Is something that is very, very good for immune function.
Mm-hmm.
In general, probably as it relates to the gut. You know, we didn't talk a lot about this, but the majority of your immune system is in your gut, so you want to have a healthy
yes.
Amount of healthy bacteria in the gut and healthy gut function.
And the red peppers have the capsaicin, which is
mm-hmm.
also very helpful in terms of a number of conditions. So that is probably one of the reasons why people use the red peppers.
Right. Yeah. It also makes the food be able to be kept longer too. I mean, the curry.
It acts as a preservative.
It preserves the food.
Yes.
So that you can eat it, you know, 7 days rather than 3.
Yes. Without becoming either moldy or
right.
in other ways inedible.
Right.
Yes.
Well, we're coming to the end of our hour. We've been interviewing Beatrice Trumhunter. Her book, Infectious Connections, How Short-Term Foodborne Infections Can Lead to Long-Term Health Problems. And I look forward to interviewing you on your next book, because at Millennium Healthcare, we do a lot of detoxification and teaching people how to avoid heavy metals and other environmental toxins that can decrease
your
immune system.
Well, I look forward to the next interview. I've enjoyed this one very much with you, Dr. Cole.
Well, thank you for joining us, Beatrice. Next week we have Marshall Klarfeld, Adam the Missing Link, and on the 22nd we have a DVD, which I'm sure, Beatrice, you're familiar with. It's called Ingredients with Greed, G-R-E-E-D, instead of ingredients. And
oh,
it's about the dangers of our food supply. We will be talking with Director David Burton. And then on the 29th, we're going to be talking with Jill Morrow, Keys to Soul Evolution, A Gateway to the Next Dimension. We have our Noetic Science meeting on the third Thursday of every month, on January 20th, at the Georgetown Square Dunwoody office. C. Leigh Culver will be discussing applied remote viewing, which is originally called coordinate remote viewing, is a method of psychoenergetic perception originally developed by the U.S. intelligence agencies and was also used in the Soviet countries. I've met some of the Soviet and I've interviewed many of the remote viewers in our military. And this should be an interesting demonstration and question and answer period on how we all can do remote viewing if we choose to develop that talent. Well, thank you, Beatrice, for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And I just remembered the name of that Asian probiotic food.
Okay.
It's kimchi.
Kimchi,
K-I-M-C-H-I.
Yes. Yeah, kimchi. That's right. That's right. I've tried that, like maybe once. But it's good for your health.
Yes.
Well, wealth of information, Beatrice. I look forward to our next interview. Please join us next week for another episode of Temple of Health.
So you had plastic surgery. What was it like?
It was great. Don't get me wrong, it was surgery, but the doctors and staff at Plastico's were terrific.
Honey, you look like $1 million. You actually went to Plastico's and had it done.
Why don't you? Plastic surgery is outpatient, and you'll only be out of work a few days. I love what Plastico's did for me, and looking my best is an investment that pays in so many ways. The help you get from the professionals at Plastico's is a bargain.
Plastico's, 770-457-4677. Mention this ad for a free consultation. Financing is available, 770-457-4677.